Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast.
S&P 500, you know, getting close to retesting those June lows. It certainly feels very heavy out there in terms of the tape. Looking across asset classes, let's check in with the professional AJ Oden, Senior Investment Strategist for BNY Mellon Investor Solutions. AJ, thanks so much for joining us here. What are you telling your clients at BNY?
Hey, thanks for having me. Right now we're telling clients, you know, we need to remain underweight in equities right now. I mean, we see the Fed that isn't going to capitulate or pivot anytime soon. And so, you know, we're staying, you know, obviously, we need to stay in the markets, but remaining underweight equities, looking for, you know, more defensive names, large cap stocks with, you know, income generating equities. We're neutral from a fixed income perspective, but we prefer short duration. However, as we start to see the 10-year continue to move up, we're going to start to add a little bit more duration in the portfolio. We're replacing that underweight in equities with an overweight in real assets just because we need to be allocated to the sources of inflation. However, pulling back on that commodity piece as we're seeing energy come down today. But that's kind of how we're positioning our clients, a little bit more defensive in nature, looking at utilities, healthcare, names like that.
What does that mean in terms of the thought that we have to have capitulation to really have a sustainable bull market? In the last hour, Paul Sweeney and I were speaking to David Sowerby, and he said, you know, we can't really tell what capitulation looks like. We don't know what the signals are. Yeah. Your take on that? What do you look for?
You know, I think we're going to have to follow the Fed here. I feel like the market for the last 14-15 years has been under this sort of understanding that, you know, the market's going to, or the Fed's going to come through, you know, ride through on a white horse and sort of save the markets when there's a massive dip like this. But, you know, we have to understand that we've benefited from the amount of quantitative easing that's come in, and that $9 trillion balance sheet as part of their mandate is trying to run that off as well. And so, you know, when inflation is persistently high like this, you know, they're waiting for to see a downward trend of that. You know, last month we're seeing inflation rise in parts of the PCE and CPI, aside from energy. And so, you know, wage pressures continue to add onto the inflation narrative until we start to see cooling in the labor markets. You can imagine the Fed's going to continue to move forward. And I felt like they gave a good projection of what the potential terminal rate could be. And so the markets at some point will stabilize as we start to see yields sort of normalize here. But obviously when you're seeing, you know, a 5 basis point swing up in the 2-year at 4.17 right now, you know, we're going to continue to see repricing until we start to see yields normalize a bit.
So you're not alone in saying that following the Fed is the way to go. But I have to talk about the precedent that set the last time the Federal Reserve hiked rates like this. I'm talking about 2016 through 2019. At the same time, they had this massive quantitative tightening operation, which was massive at the time, not of the same scale as it is right now. And the equity market actually rallied over that time frame. You had tech leading that charge despite rising rates. Why is this time different?
You know, that's a great question. What we would say here is that the reason why this time is different, I think, has a lot to do with inflation. And it's really been the sort of differentiator in the market. And many of the different exogenous supply-driven impacts that we're dealing with here. You know, Russia-Ukraine conflict is still having spillover effects. There's still the risk for energy prices to go up. And China's zero COVID policy having an impact on supply chains and any other geopolitical tensions that sit out there between China and Taiwan. But also the concept of reshoring and onshoring and how, you know, even though the Fed has a 2% target for inflation, that it's potential that we could see persistently higher inflation for longer as jobs move back to the U.S. And so I feel like inflation is that differentiator in the environment that we're seeing today. And the Fed's, and not just the Fed, but on a global perspective, major central banks trying to maintain price stability.
So, AJ, is a recession part of the BNY Mellon kind of outlook, I guess, for markets? Is that kind of what you're factoring into your models?
We're definitely looking at it. You know, I wouldn't say, you know, it's a high probability. I know we do have a more recent snapshot or projection coming out in a few weeks, so I don't want to jump ahead and give any sort of indications before that comes out. But it is something that we're weighing on. I'd say Europe and the UK, some of the news coming out about potentially being in a recession is definitely something that we're looking at as well. But you know, the US seems to be a relative outperformer when you're looking at many of the developed market countries. But to that question that you had, yes, it is something that we're looking at. But I think we believe that the Fed can still pull this off and navigate this landing of the economy.
Are you guys holding more cash than you typically do?
Yeah, we're definitely moving into a little bit more cash for sure. And even within some of our tactical asset allocation, looking at treasury floating rate securities. But like I said before, as we start to see higher yields from the 10-year, we're going to start to add a little bit more duration to the portfolio.
All right, AJ, great stuff. Really appreciate you taking the time checking in with us. AJ Oden, he's a senior investment strategist at BNY Mellon's Investor Solutions. BNY, the Bank of New York.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Nicole Dugal joins us. He's a senior vice president, general manager for automotive at Qualcomm. And you know, Qualcomm's probably got this monster booth there where it shows off all its cool stuff. Nicole, talk to us about where we are with just kind of the computerization of the automobile. I mean, Matt Miller had to wait for his Chevy Silverado truck for months because they couldn't get enough chips to fund to drive all this stuff that's in the car. Where are we now?
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for having me. Look, I think the car industry is going through this massive transformation where every automaker realizes that the platform that they are building has so much more potential, so much more capability to really create a brand identity for the automaker to connect with their customers, make it a services platform, find new ways to monetize. And really, the center of it all is chips and software. These platforms are all becoming much more advanced technologically, keeping up with the most complex technology that we are deploying today. So this progression has started. It's upon us. And we're really seeing every car company become a technology company. And our Snapdragon Digital Chassis is the basis on top of which we are building these partnerships with automakers.
Talk to us a little bit about pricing here. I mean, it's clear that chips are in demand and have been in demand and probably will be in demand, I want to say, for the next minimum year or so as we start to see the supply chain issues really abate. What does that mean for pricing? How much of a premium can you charge based on that really unabated demand?
Yeah. You know, I think automotive is and remains a very competitive space. What is changing, however, is, as we are able to integrate more and more functionality into the chips that we build, it allows us to be able to, A, bring technology, bring products over to more affordable segments of the value chain. Also, bring much more capability to the higher end. So there is certainly a price premium that we can extract by the integration capabilities that we have as we are bringing more technology to really every tier of vehicle.
All right, so Nicole, in the past couple months, I experienced two firsts for me. Number one, I drove my first pickup truck. Number two, I drove my first electric vehicle. It happened to be the electric pickup truck. And I was just blown away by the technology of that EV in terms of the performance. So, okay, I get the EV thing. That's coming. I get it. Autonomous driving, that's another thing altogether. How do you envision the evolution towards autonomous driving? Because I know Qualcomm is going to be right at the forefront of that.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And, you know, our Snapdragon Ride platform really addresses this transition towards autonomous driving. So there are a few things going on. You know, I think your experiences in terms of driving a new vehicle and really being impressed with all of the electronics inside, I think that is certainly indication of one shift. I think the other clearly is that cars are becoming safer because there is technology, yep. There are sensors, there is a lot of capability now available to make cars much more safe. The transition from safety to comfort to where you can actually allow the car to take you from point A to point B is a complex path. It is something that is going to take time because it really is about making sure that this can be implemented in a safe way. We are already seeing, for example, for highway applications, the ability for cars to be operating in autonomous mode for long durations, for long lengths of time. But as you start to bring in more variability, more randomness, there is clearly a lot of work that needs to be done. And mostly in my mind, this is actually a question of the safety responsibility that automakers owe to their consumers. So while the tech might be there, you have to do this in a very responsible fashion because you're essentially taking control away from the driver, giving you the vehicle. And that's kind of where the responsibility quotient has to be really high.
Nicole, I know you focus on the auto industry, but just I'd love to get your thoughts just over on the overall semiconductor supply issue. Kind of where are we as an industry in terms of getting supply matched with demand on a global basis? Because that was a big, big problem, continues to be a big, big problem for, you know, getting these economies kind of reopened and back up and running. Where are we, do you think?
You know, I think from an auto perspective, we've been fortunate in that we've actually been able to prioritize availability of semiconductor supply for our automaker customers ahead of all other verticals. And through COVID, we were actually able to manage that quite well. As we look at the next year or so, there are clearly still pockets of the market, you know, certain types of semiconductors that are still in short supply. Supply is catching up. But I think, through the second half of next year, I do feel that the auto industry is going to start to see a much better balance between supply and demand.
So we have about a minute left. Talk to us a little bit about the regional challenges that Qualcomm specifically might be facing. I mean, look, the auto industry is really in North America. It's in Germany as well. But a lot of the chips are coming from abroad. Talk to us about the challenges there.
Yeah, so, you know, we are a fabless company. We have partnerships globally across many different semiconductor fabrication partners. And really the way that we have established the business is to have the ability to build products across multiple locations, have dual sourcing strategies. The automotive supply chain is highly complex, and so scale is a very important factor, and you have to be able to work across a wide variety of complexity, whether it's partnerships at the front end or the back end. Because of the scale at which we operate, this is something that we've actually been able to do perhaps a bit better than some of the other more entrenched players that do not have similar scale from an overall semiconductor supply perspective.
All right, Nicole, thank you so much for joining us there. Nicole DeGaulle, Senior VP and General Manager. He covers the automotive business for Qualcomm. And again, the transition to electric vehicles well on the way. And again, the performance that I experienced was just awesome. Now the question is, you know, getting more and more autonomous. Looking at the shares of Nikola. NKLA is your ticker you can put in there. It's trading at $3.88 a share. It's off 5% today, off 60% year-to-date, 52-week low. It is ugly, but we want to talk about not so much the stock, but what's going on with its founder. Ed Ludlow joins us. Ed Ludlow is a West Coast correspondent, but he's in New York, but he's from England, so I don't know where he calls home here, but he joins us here. We'll talk about the trial of Nikola founder Trevor Milton. Ed, give us the background here on the issue here, the trial here. What's going on and kind of where are we?
So Nikola was the poster child, right, of this wave of EV companies that went public via SPAC, Special Purpose Acquisition Company, 2020 through 2021. And Milton was like billed to be the next Musk. He was this visionary who would make hydrogen-powered fuel cell semi-trucks a reality.
Yep.
And, you know, retail investors poured money into this stock. But, you know, things change really quick. You know, at one point they had a market cap greater than Ford. But just after they went public, Bloomberg reported that their first truck, their debut truck that they'd unveiled in 2016, was grossly exaggerated. Never worked, missing parts. The next thing that happens, a short seller takes notice. Cites that Bloomberg report, looks into Trevor Milton, and basically accuses him of deceiving investors. The SEC gets involved, looks into him, and ultimately, by September of that year, he resigns. A year later, he's indicted, charged with securities and wire fraud. And that is the trial that's ongoing in Manhattan right now.
So walk us through now what comes next in the trial. Walk us through the timeline. What have we seen? Where are we?
Yeah.
What do we see next?
So we're in day 10 of the trial, two working weeks in, and it's just been astonishing. You know, we've had key witnesses, including Nikola's current outgoing CEO, Mark Russell, who basically testified and told the jury that he did have a lot of concerns about things that Milton was saying, that in fact, much of what he said was not true, and that he and other executives had warned Milton that as the executive chairman of the company, everything he said equated to a press release. It equated to a securities filing. We heard from Nikola's social media manager, and a big part of the story around Milton is he was a big user of Twitter. Sounds familiar, right?
Yep.
And Instagram. And she testified that they had a policy that non-public information must not be shared on social media. She testified that only herself and Milton had access to the company's accounts. And she testified that Milton was breaching his own company's social media policies. Next, we hear from the CFO. We heard from a retail investor that says they lost $160,000 because of investing in the company based on what Milton says. That's the crux of the case, by the way.
So I see Steve Gursky, he's the chairman of the board, who's a longtime auto executive.
Yeah,
he's
former GM.
Longtime analyst. He and I used to work together way back in the day when he covered the auto stocks. He's a savvy investor, savvy auto person. It looks like Trevor Milton perhaps duped a lot of smart people, not just kind of retail investors as well, potentially.
Yeah, so I think it's important to say, like, the defense are going to argue and they're trying to prove and convince a jury that A, Milton genuinely believed what he was saying was true.
Okay.
But also that he was the CEO of the company, right? It was his duty to market the company. He was following the marketing plan. And the burden of proof, this is the American justice system, is on the prosecution to not just prove that he lied, but those lies, in fact, did prompt investors to invest. And Steve Gursky is really interesting. And that's the extra bit of this trial. that we're learning what really took place at the time. For example, yesterday, a GM, current GM employee and engineer testified that the pickup truck, the Badger, that GM had agreed initially to build on Nikola's behalf was not going to contain any parts from Nikola. Well, Trevor Milton gave an interview saying 70% of the parts would come from Nikola. So we're kind of filling the blanks of what we knew at the time.
What is the fine here? What is the defense after when it comes to, if they win this case, do the investors benefit? What is Trevor Milton costed?
Great question.
Walk us through it.
This is a criminal trial, and he faces 2 counts of securities fraud, 2 counts of wire fraud. The most severe penalty for one of the counts is 25 years in prison. And so I think most legal experts, and based on precedent, he is unlikely, if found guilty, to face that much prison time. But the other way of looking at it is the holistic picture, that they were the poster child of the EV SPAC wave. There are many commentators that would say this is kind of the shot across the bow from the government and regulators about the perils of investing in companies that went public via SPAC, and also the behavior of some of those companies. We know there are many that have encountered financial trouble. You know, it's kind of an interesting tale of, yep, of a market that's changed, a specific market.
What's the timing here? I mean, I know you're here in part to cover this trial. What's the expectation when we might get kind of winding this up and maybe get a ruling?
Yeah, so it's billed to be a 5-week trial winding up around October 14th. That's at least what the judge briefed the jury. You know, the government will need a few weeks to present their case, and they have a long list of witnesses that they've been calling. You know, and that would leave about a week for the defense before closing arguments. And, you know, this is being really closely followed, that people wanted to know what happened to this guy, but many stuck with Nikola. But you pointed out the stock, you know, the stock breached $4 for the first time. You know, the background being that most SPAC acquired companies start trading at $10 a share.
Right.
So you're out of the money, right? If you held onto your shares. You know, it's become in the background, Nikola's become a boring truck company, and at a really hard time.
I'm looking at some of the stockholders here: Vanguard Group, Norges Bank, BlackRock, some State Street. So a lot of some big funds own this thing. So I'm sure there's a lot of folks paying attention, in addition to obviously all the retail investors as well. Ed Ludlow, thanks so much for joining us there.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
All right, we got in our studio here Leo Kelly, CEO of Verdant Capital Advisors. I have no interest in any of that. I just found out, first of all, he's a graduate of the College of New Jersey in Ewing, New Jersey, which I grew up in that area, so I'm very familiar with that. That school's gotten so good so quickly. But then you worked a couple summers at Bloomberg in Princeton.
I did.
Paul just found his new best friend, guys.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can't believe he still doesn't have his badge, or his badge doesn't work. It, you know,
we'll have to get an honorary
who
one.
Who says it doesn't?
Ah, there you go. There you
got to get a.
He's in his vault. He comes in for the late night snacks.
Yeah, you got to get a free lunch sometimes.
Exactly. All right, Leo, you've been doing this wealth management stuff for a long time at Merrill, at Kelly Wealth Management, and now you got your own firm here. What do you say to your clients these days when they see their performance in 2022? Yes, 2020, 2021, great years. This year, just brutal equities and fixed income. Where do you go? So what are you telling your clients?
Well, the first thing we tell them is that they have to remain calm, as always. Yep. And but in the bigger picture, we've been talking about this inflation and rising interest rates now for a couple of years. It's never made sense to me that we could put this much money, grow M2 at 25% a year,
yep,
and not have inflation. We didn't buy into the transitory. We didn't buy into rates would remain low. So they've been prepared. I don't think you can be prepared for this, though. I don't think you'd be prepared for 8 or 9. We're running up to 4% on the 10-year. And the result of this, in my opinion, all of the money being flooded into the system, is we're moving into a secular change in interest rates. And that's going to change a lot of things in the market. So what people have relied on to be constants in the market in the past, it's all going to change. And that's what we're talking to our clients about.
Well, one of the things that we've been talking about throughout this show has been the C word, capitulation, not clients. and I'm curious if you're in the camp that says to see a sustainable rebound in the stock market, you have to see capitulation. And if your answer is yes, tell me how we discover, like how you detect it. If your answer is no, tell me why not.
Well, this is starting to feel like we're getting there. I don't think we're there yet. And I think if you think seasonally, we did get to a bear market, 20%. Bear markets do not typically go down, touch a bottom, and then run off to the races. Mm-hmm. It takes a few of these tests and often a new low before we see the bottom of a market. So we have been talking to our clients about get ready, September seasonally bad. November, December is seasonally better, right? We recover from that. And normally there's actually one more attempt at the bottom before you run off to the races.
But sorry, really quickly, they're seasonally bad because it's a reaction from what I've seen historically to usually a summer rally, like a Santa rally, followed then by some sort of correction when you have higher volume, no?
Well, we did have a rally. We had a rally off the down 20% from the summer. And again, I think more than seasonality, and I don't want to make this a technical conversation, right? More than a seasonal rally, we have to take a step back. We have higher energy prices still, even though they've come down. We've got really large inflation. We've got rapidly rising interest rates. We have an extraordinarily aggressive Fed, and replicate that everywhere in the world.
Yep.
That is not exactly what I would call stimulus. So to us, that says, be prepared for volatility. What we're telling clients is be prepared for volatility. We have to be active in the markets. Going to sleep on a 60-40 passive portfolio, those days are done. They're behind us.
That's exactly right. I mean, you think about it this year, I guess, you know, the S&P off more than 20%. Most of the bond indices that we look at here on the Bloomberg Terminal off, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13%. There's really been nowhere to hide here. To the extent you've got some clients who want to, you know, maybe take a little bit more risk, maybe put some cash into the market, where are you suggesting they look?
Well, I will be specific, but the first place is not what has been successful prior.
Okay.
As we go and we have higher interest rates and more volatility, right, that's going to impact PE. So the higher PE steady growth companies, I don't think perform as well. Now, it's not to say that they're going to go down necessarily, but I just don't think they perform as well. We like earnings power. Strong dollar means small cap looks interesting to us, right? Small cap growth and small cap value. Growth because it's down so much, value because there's value there. We like the international markets, but there's going to be tremendous volatility. International, developed international, is 2 to 3 standard deviations lower in valuation, relative valuation, than what we see in the norm, than the median. Yeah. So to me, that says, let's put some money there. And yes, we're going to have to go through the gyrations of the market. But as we tell our clients, when you invest in equity, you sign a contract. And that contract says, I know there's going to be volatility. I accept that for a higher rate of return, and I'm willing to put up with it. Well, now's the time to earn your money.
To make good on that. All right, Leo Kelly, thank you so much for joining us. Leo Kelly is the CEO of Verdance Capital Advisors, joining us live in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio here today. So we've got central bankers around the world raising interest rates to try to tame inflation at the risk of recession. And then I wake up this morning, and that includes the Bank of England. And then, you know, we wake up this morning, we see the UK announces its biggest tax cut since 1972. What is up with that? Talk about, it seems like a lack of coordination. So we figured we got to get Ed Price in here. He's a senior fellow and former British trade official from NYU. Ed, what do you make of your English government and this tax cut vis-a-vis kind of what the Bank of England is trying to do with other central banks?
Sure thing. Thanks, Paul. At odds, I think, is a fair enough description straight off the bat. At odds. I would say that the point of the Conservative Party is in part, as we said earlier, cutting taxes.
Okay.
So that's not surprising. But it's kind of ignoring context. And so the other point of the Conservative Party is fiscal responsibility. Fiscal responsibility this ain't. So if you're asking me what the Bank of England is doing, probably not enough. We're at 2.25. They'll have to go higher. And the policy mixture, the policy posture in the UK seems to me to be inflationary, in an inflationary context, no?
Well, I guess my question here is, if you are, and I'm trying to be as empathetic as possible, so
right,
help me be in their shoes, quite mm-hmm. literally. If you are Andrew Bailey, you are in the Bank of England, it totally makes sense to be restrictive right now. If mm-hmm. you are on the political side and you are seeing people getting laid off, not being able to afford housing bills, et cetera, then it makes sense to stimulate the economy from that perspective. But why is this not being done in a coordinated manner? I mean, Liz Truss was very open about wanting to do this when she was campaigning.
Right. Is economic policy ever coordinated?
You tell me.
I don't think it is. I don't know if that's a cop-out answer, but I don't think it is. And I think that, yes, Liz Truss, the Prime Minister, was open about being someone who would cut taxes. And yes, of course, our back is against the wall vis-a-vis energy. So, of course, again, there has to be some sort of fiscal intervention because people are going to be cold. It's that simple, right?
Yeah.
But again, the Bank of England is probably thinking our independence is the most important thing. And to what extent do we have to hike to demonstrate that our independence is the most important thing? Let's remember that we're facing an inflationary supply side shock on the energy side.
Right.
Right. So that if you look at rates, that's kind of also a bit on the one hand, on the other. You might say, well, let's cut rates to fight the deflationary pressure, the unemployment that results from that. On the other hand, and I think at 9.9%, this is what you should do. You should hike to fight that inflation.
Right. But that, sorry, they're at odds with each other at the end of the day. So it's kind of like neither side almost gets the full effect of what they're trying to achieve because they counteract. Talk to us a little bit about the politics of it as well. When you walked in here, I asked you about the Conservative Party specifically. They mm-hmm. haven't cut taxes for, I think, 3 years, mm-hmm. but that's part of their party line.
That's part of their DNA. Right. If you vote Conservative, you are voting for a tax cut. And they've delivered. Right. They've cut. What is it? They've cut 45p, the top rate, down to 40.
Well, their timing is impeccable because they haven't done it for 3 years and now they're doing it.
Right. Well, it's always a good time to cut taxes if you're a Tory. Right. I don't think it's a bad time. So that's 2 billion and then 5 billion out of the basic rate. So I think, again, I'll go back to context, Kriti, and say that makes sense without context. In context, it seems to me like it's sort of shooting your load a bit early. I think what we're doing as a country is saying, bet on us in the medium term. Bet on us after this spending comes through the system, comes through the economy. There's probably a two-year lag on economic policy anyway. Then take another look at us, right? Because at that point, we will be in different shape relative to other jurisdictions and other economies.
So looking at the pound sterling here, broke below 110. We're now at 1.0932. A couple of people today have said the UK economy looks kind of like an emerging market here.
I'm outraged.
Currency.
I'm outraged, Paul. I'm leaving immediately.
Exactly. I mean, what do you make of the sterling here and the trading?
Well, I came on your show previously and said that parity was something we should be talking about. So I think that's, I'm not going to deny that is realistic. emerging markets. I mean, that's a bit of a cheeky finance meme, isn't it? That's something for Twitter.
Well, to be fair, I saw this on Jens Nordvig, who's the CEO and founder of Exante Data. He's a former FX head of Goldman, I believe. And he said that the way you define an emerging market currency, forgive me, he's like giving me the depth.
I'm ready for it. Go
on. He says the way you define emerging market currency is when you have basically in the United States, for example, when you have yields go higher, it supports the dollar, interest rate differentials. They said emerging market currency is the opposite of that,
which
the pound, the cable rate is actually supporting. So technically,
yes,
in theory, by that definition,
I'll split the difference with you and I'll say a very high quality emerging market. Okay. and again,
how British of you.
I'm very British. But I think that the future is unwritten. And again, this is all coming out of Brexit, right? So Sterling is rewriting its core narrative. The old Sterling narrative was we've got Anglo-Saxon innovation and European market size. That was very juicy. Now that has to change because we've left the EU. I don't think that rules out future roles for Sterling as a hedge in the world against other narratives that will also change. So I'm optimistic in the sense that the UK is like front-loading its 21st century supply side shock, or one of them, and reacting to these things that we're seeing, like COVID and Ukraine, in a way that ultimately is agile and ultimately, you know, with agility, there's always a premium in the medium term.
Right.
What's the feeling? How tough will this winter be for Europe, for the UK? What's the thinking these days in terms of energy and all that type?
Yeah, well, tough.
Yep.
Tough. I think that if we sort of move over the channel to the Germans, Scholz is not happy. We saw that the other day. I said earlier, people are going to get cold, and I think I'll stand by that. I think some people are going to be cold, and it might be worse than that. If you think about elderly people, if you think about children, if you think about businesses and firms shutting down, it's not just temperature, it's also going to be activity. So I think it's very tough. But looking even further, right, further east, I'm not sure that Putin is having the best time that he, you know, the best time that he thought he would.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. A lot of geopolitical issues out there. Today, it just happened to be the United Kingdom. Again, big, big tax cuts in the face of rising interest rates and a slowing economy. Ed Price joins us. He's a senior fellow at NYU, a former British trade official, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.